Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about handling page faults, that when a process tries to access a virtual page and the processor looks up in the page table and says, oh, the operating system didn't specify anything for this, that triggers a page fault. If the processor looks up the page in the page table and it's not writable, that triggers an exception. And sort of what we've thought of happening so far is that, oh, we're going to just, that's an error. The program's accessing stuff it shouldn't access. But we don't have to treat it that way. That instead of making the program crash and saying it didn't do something it's supposed to do, we could have a different notion of what memory we promised the program would have. And when a page fault happens, we can say, well, did we promise the program it would have memory that would work this way? And fix it up to make that so. So one example of this was allocate on demand. That we'd say when a program allocates memory, for example, when we start the program, we don't need to allocate all that space in advance because, well, that's going to take some time. That's going to take some time when we're not going to be able to start running the program. So instead, we can just pretend we've allocated the space and, well, that's going to get us in trouble at some point. The program's going to try to access some memory that we're supposed to have allocated. And at that point, we can fix this problem. We can say, okay, that page wasn't allocated. Why wasn't it allocated? Oh, it wasn't allocated because I skipped allocating it earlier. Let's do it now. And as long as we do it in the page fault handler, we can return. It's going to retry the access, and it's going to work the second time. So from the program's point of view, it's like we already allocated it in advance, even though we're doing it at a later point. And we had a similar idea for implementing fork. So fork, we have this crazy thing where we copied all of a program's memory. And we saw when we were running the shell that often when we actually fork, we don't actually use most of that memory. We're just doing a little bit of stuff. It's not going to touch most of the memory. So we don't really need a full copy. So what we can do instead of making a full copy is we can just make everything read-only. And then when one of the processes tries to modify that memory, then we can make a copy. So we pretend we've made a copy, but we actually just set things read-only. So if our pretending is wrong, we'll know. We'll know because there will be an exception saying, oh, the program tried to write to that thing which was supposed to be a copy. And at that point, we actually make the copy, update the page table to reflect that. And this sort of idea of sort of having a notion of here's the memory I assigned to the program, and having it not necessarily be the same as what you tell the processor. That's a common sort of strategy operating systems can use. And we finished up last time mentioning sort of one thing we can do with this, which was mmap, which we'll get to as our first topic today. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes? Question on the quiz, yes. Question one? So what about it?
So I get the last part 48. What the mock page turn function does, it uses the page number, virtual page number 12, and then multiplies that by 4 using array. Did this use last part 48 then?
So the question is, where did the 4.8 come from? And you're saying, is it because it used 12 and multiplied that by 4 because of the randomness? Yeah, so in the walk page for implementation, we don't actually have the number 4 appear, but we have an array in that access, and the array is an array of ints, or unsigned ints, which are, you know, page table entries. Those are 4 bytes. The compiler is going to generate a multiply by 4. Yes?
Quiz question. Where did I press? So, question 3. Okay. 3 or 2?
2.
Okay.
When you try to write to a read-only, say
table, it would fault, and then it would send the macro bits for the next 4 kilobytes of pages. So starting at OX3, I figured it would set the bits from OX3 to OX7, so that would all be one fault.
So the question is, we have an access at OX3, and you're saying, since that brings in 4K, what 4K does it bring in? So the two things about that. So 4 kilobytes in hexadecimal is 1000. It's not 4000. So it could be 3000 to 3FFF, or it could be some other range that constitutes a page. It happens to be 3000 to 3FFF, and why is that? Because it has to match the way we divided up memory into pages. And remember, we said we're going to take the whole memory and we're going to divide it up into pages, and those pages are going to start at multiples of the page size. That the first page, page 0, has to start at address 0, meaning page 1 has to start 4K later, which is address 1000 in hex. It can't start at 1008 or anything like that, because it has to start exactly that much later. So if we look at how that works in this case, 3000 is the beginning of a page, and that's going to be where we're going to allocate that 4K. That 4K gets us 3000 to 3FFFF. Does that answer your question?
Okay, my original thought process was that 4 kilobytes mapped from OX3 to OX7.
Yeah, so 4 kilobytes. So if it was actually 16 kilobytes, which is 4000 bytes in hex, then if that was our page size, then our first page would be 0 through 3, 3FFF. And our second page would be 4 through 7FFF. So it still wouldn't be the case that you get 3 to 7 because that doesn't line up with the first page starting at 0. Does that make sense? Okay, other questions? Yeah?
So in question 4, how does it know
So the question is, for question 4,
yeah.
how does it know that we don't make, so your question is that we have accesses to the stack in both the parent and the child. And we know from question 3 that we only end up making one copy, or needing one extra page, I should say. Yeah, so we only end up needing one extra page. So the way this is probably going to work is that we're going to whichever one runs first is going to make a copy, and then whichever one runs second is going to say, oh, do I need a copy? And it's going to find out. So two things could happen. So one thing is that it wouldn't be a crazy implementation to make a copy and then say, oh, the original no longer is used, get rid of it. More efficient would be to say, have that check, is the original still used by anyone else, and say no, and just not make a copy. But we need some way of keeping track of how many processes are using a page in order to not leak memory. So we're going to have some mechanism for that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also have a question about question 1. So I guess if we look at it from a bit of a superficial perspective, one page dir returns the second level page table entry. But when I was looking at the problem, I was looking at a line-by-line implementation, and because in the code you go to the else statement when you do the bitwise AND with the PTP value, which is 1, in that else statement there's that if statement that says if not Alec.
So the question is, in walk page dir we have this if statement based on whether the first level page table entry has the present bit set.
Yes.
So in this case I can infer from the question that must be true. It must be set, we must go to the then part of that if statement. And that's because there is a second level page table entry that the processor found. And when the processor, when it does its page table lookup, it's also checking that present bit. And in order for it to go from the first level to the second level and not trigger a page fault, it had to find that present bit was set. Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of, because I got the first 10, I was manually trying to get the first 10 bits of 0x12345, and when I did that computation,
Okay, so the question is about the first, how did I find the first 10 bits of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? So remember, our addresses are 32 bits. So if you weren't accounting for the leading zeros, you probably got the wrong answer. And is that what the question was about?
I'm pretty sure I was accounting for the leading zeros, but my last bit also ended up being a zero, so I must have done the calculation wrong, I believe.
So, but I would say because of the leading zeros, the first 10 bits of that address should be all zeros. Which is how we got that first level page table entry is the first entry in the page table and not something else. Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question is what the XV6's PTE adder function does. So this extracts the base address of a page. So the base address, a page table entry points to. And the way this works is that, if you recall, our page table entry have flags, like that present bit, and a physical page number. So this extracts the physical page number and combines it with zero for a page offset. And it turns out we can do that by just using a bitwise AND operation to zero out the flags. Does that answer your question? Other questions?
Can you explain why in number 3, I think there isn't a fourth page for the stack?
Question, why isn't there a fourth page that we need to copy for the stack? So there's two things going on. So observe that both of the stack accesses in the parent and child are to the same virtual page number. So in order to support both the parent and child executing with different stacks, we need different stacks. We need two pages for what they're writing and one page for the thing they never touch. So that two pages means one extra page. Another way of looking at it is that if we think of the copying operations, if the parent runs first, we're going to copy the stack for the parent, and then when the child runs, we don't need to make a copy anymore because it's already copied. The child is already running on a copy that's not shared with the parent.
So, why don't you need a new page for the code since both of them are the same page?
Question, why don't I need a new page for the code? When we execute code, we don't write it. So, it's true we write the stack, but that's not part of the code. So, the code just shouldn't change, so we don't need to make a copy of it. Other questions? Okay, so last time we mentioned that we have this memmap function. This is, sorry, yes?
Copy on write, you assume that once you're like, giving up a parent and child process, that like, going to the same physical address, once, say, a parent creates writes, and you're allocating another physical page, and then we apply that write to that physical page. If a child writes the same address,
Question, if our child, so question, if we have copy on write, we fork, we make a copy of a page for the parent, and the child tries to write to the same virtual page, which should be, the child should have an impact copy, will the child end up writing to the same original page? That's probably the most efficient implementation, but we could implement copy on write and not do that, and it'd still be correct, just inefficient. Does that answer your question? Does XV6 do that? XV6 doesn't do copy on write, which is why it's part of the assignment. So XV6 does the stealthy implementation of fork we talked about, where we actually copy everything on fork. Other questions? Okay. So we were talking about this sort of magical mmap call. So the way mmap works is we call it, and we get this pointer to some virtual address that is set up such that when we access it, we could be actually accessing the file. And like in a very real sense, it's not like we've written a copy of the file. It could be the case that when we modify that stuff, it modifies the file. So let's talk about how mmap is called. I kind of omitted a bunch of the arguments on that slide. So mmap takes an address, which it turns out won't matter very much. And it takes a length, a file descriptor, and an offset. And the file descriptor is the file that we're setting up as part of our memory. We set up starting at offset bytes into the file, and we map length bytes. So we specify how much we want to map. And we also specify what sort of setup we want that memory to have. And one thing we can specify is whether that memory should be readable, writable, executable, or some combination of those. So it turns out that mmap is sort of basically how executable loading is going to work. That's why executable is an option. When we want to load code, we're going to often end up using mmap to do that. We have the option of making it writable or executable if you want, or even making it so it always segfaults. Yes?
So what is file FD and what would omitting FD do?
So question, what is FD? So FD is a file descriptor from open. From open. So it's one of the open files, and remember that array of file descriptors, like with Duke 2 and so on? One of those.
And so if we were to omit FD.
And for omitting it, you specify, it turns out you actually specify -1 and set flags to something special. That question, what's the behavior of that? We'll talk about that later. Other questions?
So the props can tell you like what you can do at those memory locations?
Yes, proc tells you what you can do. And we haven't talked about the flag setting, which we'll get to next. Other questions? Okay, so we also have flags, and flags let us specify a bunch of options, but the two most important are that mappings can be shared, meaning that the mapping actually changes the file, or they can be private, meaning that we're going to get our own copy of the file's data, and that copy is typically going to be implemented with copy on write. Yes? So the question, in the case of using mmap to modify a file, if I set it the length 20 bytes, does that do anything to those 20 bytes? So it only doesn't, so it makes it so you can access those as part of your memory. If you access that part of your memory, then you can do things with the file. Then it will change the file. If it's a shared mapping, if it's a private mapping, you'll get a private copy. So if you modify it, you'll have your own copy. And you specify a size, but it's going to turn out that mmap needs to actually work in pages. So if you specify a size of like 20 bytes, it's going to be rounded up to a full page because it kind of has to be. Okay, so we have these two types of mappings we can have. We can have these shared mappings that actually modify the file, like the example I showed, the thing that's really magical, or these private mappings, which are going to be copy on write. So just a fast way of copying the file into your memory, where it's fast because we aren't actually going to copy unless we need to. Okay. And so if the shared mapping reflects the real file, it's going to turn out we're going to need to make sure that the pages we give you, the physical pages that the page table points to, are going to be the same ones anyone else accessing the file uses. And also that if you change those pages, they get written to disk at some point. We can also set multiple flags, and the notable one I mentioned that we can omit an FD. So Linux, this is not a POSIX feature, doesn't exist in all the Unix-likes, but Linux tries to treat sort of all program memory as basically a bunch of mmaps. But this means that we have to deal with memory that doesn't have a file corresponding to it. So the way Linux deals with this is we can have what they call anonymous mappings, ones which don't have an underlying file. In this case, rather than getting data from a file, we just allocate new space. new empty space, probably zeroed out space. And there's more flags, but we're not going to talk about them much. And I should mention the address. So the address is a suggestion about what virtual address you'd like the mapping to be placed at. For the most part, we're not going to use it. It's a suggestion because it might be ignored, and it's not mandatory unless you use the mapfix flag. This is occasionally useful for things like, let's say I have an executable that expects to be loaded in a particular place in memory. We can do it with this. But for the most part, we're just going to pass null to say, I don't care. Questions? Yes. Okay, so let's do exercise. So here's some uses of mmap. We have a file, hello.txt. We're going to map it as shared for p1, as private, so remember that's copy on write for p2, and as shared but read-only for p3. And we do a bunch of manipulations to p2 and p1, and also read from the file directly, and then we print out our results. This format here, %3s, this is a 3-character string. My question is, what is our output that we're going to get from this? We would expect to get from this. Who'd like some more time? Not seeing many people. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so of those who answer, we have pretty good consensus on D, and that's like at 2. So P1 and P3 are both shared mappings of the file. So they change the real file and also change everything. So our real text file, initially it contains foo, F-O-O. Then we change P2. P2 is a private copy. It's created with copy on write, so we're not going to see it change yet, but when we modify the B, that's going to change to not B there. Sorry, I need to pay attention to what character is being modified. This is going to change index 2. The last character is going to change there. Then we modify using P1, and that's the real file. So P1 and P3 both point here, and we change the last character to X, second to last to I, with these two assignments. And then when you read from the file, we're reading from the actual text version, so that same memory. So we're going to get the modified version. Yes? Question, what does the prot read and prot write flex do? This says that the memory returned by P1, or by the, into P1, should be readable and writable, versus P3 should be read-only. Yes? What happens when you try to write to P3? Most likely, you will get your program will crash. And on Linux, that will actually be true. On some, it's not guaranteed. And a reason why it's not guaranteed is because if we think of, like for example, in XV6, like we can't specify that memory is like executable but not readable, for example, even though that's a flag you can set. So. They're supported if the hardware lets you, but sometimes the hardware won't let you set certain combinations, so the OS will give you extra permissions for free. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that is the answer. Yeah.
Are we allowed to allocate more memory than what is actually in the text for the factors and math?
Question, are we allowed to allocate more space? I'm not exactly sure how MF deals with that. I'm not sure if you have to make the file bigger first or not. Yeah.
If you printed P1, it would also be fixed.
If I printed P1, it would also be fixed? Yes.
And there's no issue.
What?
There's no issue, it doesn't cause any.
There's no issue reading, yes. There's no issue with reading P1 because it is readable. If it was only writable, maybe there would be an issue, though most hardware does not actually support making write-only memory in the page table.
Yeah.
But if it could, that would be an issue.
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so on Linux, I mentioned we can do this mmap. Linux kind of manages the program's memory as a list of mmap calls that were previously made. So for example here, I'm running the program cat, which prints out a file, and it's printing out this very special file, procselfmaps, which is a dump of the data structures internal to the Linux kernel for debugging purposes of all the maps, mmap calls registered for a program. So for the cat program, we have this surprisingly long list of mmap calls which have basically happened and been recorded, and this is how Linux views the program's allocated, or set up, I should say, memory. Now, this is for debugging, and they neglected to put labels on the columns here, so we'll talk about what these are. So the first column here is the range of virtual addresses that were mapped. So there was some call to mmap, or something like a call to mmap, that returned address 400000 and mapped B000 bytes, so we have this range of bytes. Was mapped. And this mapping was with the protection flags for reading and executing, and was a private mapping, not a shared mapping. That's what this set thing here means, so readable, executable, and P for private. And this mapping was starting at offset 0 of the file bincat. So if we think of what this mapping's for, well, it's executable, it's part of the cat file. This is loading the code for the cat executable. So the way Linux did this internally is when we ran the cat program, it turned that into a bunch of mmap calls to load the program into memory. And one of them is this that loaded the executable code as readable and executable to this address. Also printed out in this output is some information which is about this file. We'll talk about what this means later when we talk about file systems, but this is another way of identifying the file that is more directly useful for actually reading the file internally. So we have this mapping that's sort of as if something made this sort of call to mmap, and this is what was loading the executable so we could execute it. So this is a sort of read-only mapping that's executable. So how is the memory for this going to be managed? So we're going to have our bin cat file, and what we're going to see is going to happen is we're going to cache parts of files in memory. We're going to keep parts of files in memory. Just in general, why would you want to do that? It's going to be faster, right? We don't want to read from disk all the time. So we're going to keep files in memory. And we're going to have some pages of the file that we're keeping in memory. And we're going to set up this mapping. And we have these virtual pages that should correspond to the file where the sort of authoritative version of the file, the real version, is stored on disk or an SSD. So this is our bincat file on disk. And part of it we have cached in memory. We have a copy of it in memory. Maybe we ran cat before, and we still have some of the things we've written lying around. And the simplest thing we could do is when the MF call happens, we just record that in that list of maps, and we wait for cat to run. And when cat runs, it's going to try to access some of this memory. And our page table initially is just all invalid. So it tries to use, say, this page table entry. It's invalid. We're going to get a page fault. And on the page fault handler, we say, OK, I know it needs to correspond to this file, and I have a copy of it in memory already. So I'll just set the page table entry to point to there and return. The program could also access some memory that we don't have a cached copy of. That's fine. Our page fault handler is going to do a bit more work. We're going to have to load the file from disk or SSD, that page of the file. Then we can set up the page table entry and resume the program. So this is kind of like the allocate on demand idea, except that our data ultimately comes from the file on disk or SSD. And that's sort of the implementation of the read part of these mappings. So questions? How this works?
So you can have files that aren't pointed.
So question, I can have files that aren't pointed to? What do you mean by that? That aren't allocated in memory. So yeah, so the file could not be cached in memory at all, in which case we'd have to handle every single page like this. We'd get a page fault for it. We'd load it into memory, then point to it. Now, you might say, well, no, maybe we should load some more of the file in advance. We'll talk about that a little later. But indeed, there's some things I'm doing here where I'm waiting until the last possible moment to do something. And an operating system could do something earlier. Like we could say, oh, you're loading the first page of cat. Maybe I should load the second and third page just in case while I'm here. And that's something OSs really do. But to keep things simple, I'm going to show the simplest sort of implementation that might not be the most efficient thing. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is our read-only pages. In our prior examples, I showed you the idea of having shared mappings. So how do shared mappings work that are writable now, right? So reading can work the same way, but how does writing work? So we're gonna have our mapping after we've read through parts of it. We're gonna have some pages that point to our cached file data. And the important thing for a shared mapping is that this cached file data is going to be used by everyone who has a shared mapping of the file and for read and write. So the read and write system calls, they're not going to go to disk. They're going to check for this cached version, and they have to because it could have a change. So read is going to go to this cached version before it goes to anything else. And this means if I write to one of these cached pages through my shared mapping, I change that page. And if read is called then, it's going to read that changed page. Now, something I need to arrange here is I need to make sure I remember after that write happens that eventually I modify what's on disk. Because right now, the data on disk is wrong. It's not the current version of the file. I need to make sure that when I get rid of this page from memory, that it goes to disk. So the copy on disk is up to date after we say we reboot, or if we just free up this memory for some reason. So questions about how we deal with shared mappings and this idea that this memory is also going to be used by read and write. So we have some other types of mappings in our cat executable. So we have a page here, which is mapped as read-write, but private. So this means that they get a copy on write copy of this data. And you might say, why are we doing this to run cat? This is probably where cat's global variables are, and what's in the executable is the initial values. And it's mapped read-write because we might edit some of those variables while we're running the program. And we don't want it to be the case that if one copy of cat sets a global variable one way, that all the other copies of cat see that change. So each one wants to have a private copy. So again, for this memory, we're going to have a mapping, and reads are going to work like before. We're going to have some things that point to our cache copy of the cat executable, but sometimes we might have a write. So let's say we write here. Since it's copy on write, we're going to have an exception happen because it's going to be mapped as read-only in the page table. But we're going to say in the OS, oh, okay, I promised you that this was a private copy of bin cat, so I actually need to make a copy now. So to make that copy, we're going to allocate some new space for that copy and update the page table to point to it. And this new space is not going to be part of the cached copy of the file because any other instance of cat shouldn't use it. So it's going to be just for this mapping. So questions? Oh, sort of how we deal with our private copy on write case. Yeah. So question is, this copies in cache. This copies in memory. It is not part of the cached version of the file because it should never go back to the file. Right? The changes we make should never make it back to the file. Okay. Your question? Is there a process to merge changes to a file from multiple programs? So for these private copies, the changes never go back to the file. And with our example of like the global variables in cat, right, we're just copying them because we just have a template from the executable, but that never gets written back. In the case where we actually are modifying the file, we don't have a merging process because the memory is actually the same memory. So if I had another program with a shared mapping, it would have its own page table that would point to the same physical pages. So it would immediately see the changes I make. And as if two programs made changes to the same part of memory, well, it would be whichever is first, like we've seen with multi-threading. Does that answer your question? Or whichever is second would is the change which would happen, which we would see with multi-threading. So the question is, let's say one program's writing to the file and its writes haven't been pushed to the file in memory. So is the program writing to the file using mmap? Like, does it have an mmap version of the file? So if it has mmap version of the file, like if it's written to this page using, if it's accessed those virtual addresses to write, they're written. If not, they aren't. So if the program's writing the file using mmap, the write happens when it uses those virtual addresses it got from mmap, like that array that represents the file. When it writes to that, that's when its writes happen. And you know, when its writes happen versus anyone else determines what actually ends up in the file.
So after you write, are the writes loaded back into the file? Or like?
The question is, after you write, are the writes back in the file? Yes. So this cache data version of the file, this is the current copy of the file.
Okay.
And the part of this file on disk is now out of date. Does that answer your question?
If another program was to write simultaneously, would it know that there's an existing page of file data that is being written?
So the question, if another program's writing, would it know about this existing page of file data? Not directly, but because all our reads and writes to the file use the same physical pages, we would see that data immediately. So if we read immediately after the write, we're reading from that page, we're going to see the changed version. Does that answer your question? So we're never, for example, when reading the file, if we have this cache page here, we're never going to read from the disk. Always going to use the cache version. Does that answer your question? Okay, so yes. And it's very important that we always use the cache version because it could be more up to date than the version on disk. Then we have these copies, which are not part of the file. They're just something separate. Okay, so let's say I mmap, and I do an mmap call to load foo.data, the first fffff bytes of it, so 64k of it, and I end up mapping it to virtual address 10000. And this means that address 10000 corresponds to byte 0 of foo.dat and say 11000 to byte 0x1000 of foo.dat and so on. And my program, using this mapping, reads from some virtual addresses, writes to some virtual addresses, and this is a private copy-on-write mapping. My question is, how many page or protection faults happen in this process? Assuming we do everything on demand. We aren't taking any shortcuts of like filling things in advance, reading things in advance. And we have this set up where initially we have a lot of the file cached in memory already. But the rest of it we'd have to read from disk if we wanted to get it. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks two or fewer exception page or protection faults? Three? 4, 5, 6 or more. Okay, so we have a pretty big split. So let me go through how I would... So first we have these reads to these addresses, and this is virtual page 0x13, 0x14, and 0x15. Those are the virtual pages that this range includes parts of, and we want to think in virtual pages because the first time we access a virtual page, read a virtual page, that's when we're going to set up the page table entry under the assumption here that it's filled in on demand only. And for write, the first time we write, that's when we're going to handle dealing with writing to it. So initially, virtual page 3, virtual page 3, 14 and 15, aren't mapped. And it happens that virtual page 3 has a page in memory and virtual page 5 has a page in memory initially. I should probably draw this in. Has a page in memory. So it has a page in memory, has a page in memory for both of these, and a 14 doesn't. So what's going to happen is we're going to have a page fault for page 13, and that's going to be simple. We're just going to allocate, set up a page table entry for that to point to our already in-memory page. It's already in memory because it's bytes 3 through 3FFF. That's already loaded in memory according to the question. Then for virtual page 4, we're going to have to load this from disk into memory and set up the page table entry for that. I should be using the orange. So we load this from disk into memory. So this is loaded from memory. And for 15, we just set up the page table entry. So that's 3 page faults, one of which was a lot more complicated to handle than the other because we had to load something from memory. Then on these writes, we're going to write to pages 0x14 and 0x15. And to do the write, we need to have a separate copy of the data. So we're going to make that on the right. So on the right, we're going to make a new copy to point to of 14 and 15. And that's going to be 2 more page faults. So that's how I get 5. So we have our first page fault to just set a page table entry to point to a cached copy. And our thirds does that. Our second page fault needs to actually load something from disk. And then we have to do trigger copies for the 2 pages we overwrite. So questions about how I got this answer? Okay, and if the program, if the operating system didn't fill everything on demand, yes, this could have fewer page faults. So it wouldn't be crazy for the operating system to, when it sets up the mapping, to say, oh, I already have these pages cached, let's fill in those page table entries in advance. That's sort of a design decision whether that's worth the speed up or not. Yes? Question, just because something is in memory doesn't mean we have a mapping to it? Yes. So those are separate operations. And it's obviously, and I guess the big reason why it's convenient not to do that is that if a lot of programs have the same file loaded and you load it into memory, you don't want to immediately set up all those mappings. Question, for an overwrite, unless we have an existing copy, we will allocate a new one. For a copy on write mapping, yes. Which is what this is. Other questions? Okay, so looking back at our list of maps for this cat program, we have one which is a little weird here. This is the heap. So the heap is treated as a mapping of a file, but wait, there's no file to correspond to. And we can see that here in that the data structure that's being dumped here has all zeros for the information about the file and this sort of comment that this is the heap. So what Linux does internally is, even though we have like an S-break system call, it tracks the heap as just another special nmap call, basically. But it doesn't have a corresponding file. And there's also some other mappings like this. And basically what has happened is that I mentioned the anonymous flag, that we can have mappings that aren't backed by a file. So how do these work? Well, for putting them into memory, it's pretty much the same, except that we don't have any copy on disk, so when the program tries to access something, we're going to allocate that page. So we do allocate on demand, so rather than loading something from disk, we just fill in a page with zeros. Where things get a little more complicated is, what if we want to free up some of this memory to store something else? It doesn't seem like we have a place to put that, but what Linux and most other modern OSs do instead is they say, well, I'm going to decide on a place to put this stuff on disk. So even though there's no file to put it in, we're going to make up a file. So if I want to free up this space, I will put a place on disk for it, which is going to be called swapping out data, and I will place it on disk temporarily. Even though there was no file specified, I'll make a file up for it. And that gives me the same options to manage this memory as memory that is backed by a file. Okay, so questions about this idea that even though we don't have a file, we just make up a file to have the option of removing it from memory and getting it back later. Okay. And we're going to apply the same idea of making up a file for private copies. So if we think of this mapping here, where I have a private copy of global variables, we saw that sort of the scenario we have is like we'd have part of the file cached, like as the original version, we had this copy. But what if, you know, we're trying to free up memory? So we free up all of the original version, and we still need to free up more memory. Well, we'd like to free up this, but we can't put it in the file because that would be modifying data that's, you know, share it with other people, not our private copy. But what we can do is we'll just make a place, a file to hold our private copy and store it there. So we'll assign, just like we did for the heap, we'll assign a place on disk to store this if we want to free up that memory. Okay, so questions? Yes?
So, just from like a top-down perspective, so basically the memory that's been copied into, or the file data that's been copied into memory on that pad needs to be removed. That's being duplicated onto the disk again, so you have the original.
So question, if memory that's been allocated from a file that needs to be moved onto disk again, We have the original, yes, because the sort of, for shared mappings, or for read-only mappings in general, like we have the authoritative version of that is on disk. Authoritative in the sense that like it's where we know the data needs to end up at some point. For this data which doesn't have a backing file, we're going to make up a place on disk for it, because it doesn't sort of naturally have one. Is that answer your question?
Because you have the original data, and then you have like fragments of the mmap version of the data, basically.
The question, I have the original data and fragments of the mmap version. That is one way of looking at it. Sort of how we're going to manage these things in practice is we'll kind of treat each page of the file as a separate thing. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
The big advantage of this scheme is you get to reuse a lot of the existing code for the management of taking parts of the page.
So the question is, the advantage of the scheme that we get to reuse a lot of the existing code? Yeah, so all the memory is kind of handled similarly. That's a nice big advantage. It also lets us do things where we have the option of removing parts of the heap or private copies of data that aren't in common use to disk to free up memory for other things. your question?
No.
Okay. Okay. So this idea, what we end up with is that sort of all our data in memory has some sort of place it belongs on disk. Either it's part of a file, in which case it sort of belongs in that file, or it's some, you know, private copy of that file or temporary data where we'll make up a place on disk for it. And this means we can view the stuff we're actually storing on memory as sort of a temporary, quote-unquote, copy of the data on disk that we're just keeping in faster storage, because it's sure a lot faster to use it from physical memory than from disk. And we can treat this as sort of a caching problem. And then the question is, how do we manage this cache intelligently? How do we decide what things we actually want in physical memory, what things we don't? How do we do the operations of putting things into this cache and taking them out? And we'll, that's going to be our topic for the rest of the day and also next time. So this is a cache for everything in memory, which is parts of files and sort of parts of temporary data, which we're going to assign a place on disk so we can put them there if we need to. And I have this big complicated diagram of sort of the information we're tracking. We're going to go through it in pieces. So we have our cache, and we have our cache hits. And there's two ways we access the cache. One way is that we're writing a program. It accesses a virtual address, and that should actually go to a cached version. Well, that's a cache hit. It's using the page table. So the page table is going to be managed by the hardware. And therefore, because the hardware is doing the lookups, the structure is determined by the hardware. It's going to be set by the OS, but the hardware does all the lookups. So the hardware decides what the page table looks like. And we hope that most of our accesses are hits in this cache. We don't want them to often be triggering page faults. But the OS also accesses file data sort of more directly. We have read and write, which need to look up where do I find a particular byte of a file. We have our mmap implementation. When we're handling a page fault, we need to look up where is this file cached. So we're going to need to have some data structure that the OS uses that tracks for every file where are the cached pages. So if we think of our diagram, it's cache, it's like figuring out, telling us about where this blue, these blue boxes are for every file. So that's going to be some data structure the OS needs to manage, but since the only the OS reads that data structure, it can decide in what format is appropriate for it. It's not going to be determined by the hardware like our page table. So questions about our cache hit case? So our two types of cache hits. Yeah. Question, what's the difference between a memory access and a read slash write? By a read and write, I mean the read or write system call. Okay. So this goes through the system call interface rather than being just a page table access. Other questions? Okay. So another thing we need to worry about in implementing this cache is allocating pages to put things in. And I'm going to call the process of allocating pages page replacement. This is a very common term for this. You might say, well, that doesn't make sense. And the name comes from our assumed common case. Our common case is going to be, we're going to assume, it's not going to always be true in practice, but it's true enough. So every physical page is in use. And this is because, ideally, we're caching tons of stuff. We have all sorts of files we could keep in memory, and it would be nice to, sure, use all that memory efficiently. So, you know, hopefully we're caching all sorts of stuff, and this means, though, when we want to put something new in memory, we have to take something out. And that means we're replacing something that's currently used to cache one thing and making it cache something else. So the process of allocating a page for something is going to be really replacing something else. So I'm going to call it page replacement, even though in some cases, yes, the thing we're replacing is going to be unused. But often it will be something that's actually in use that we're just saying is not as important as the new thing we're allocating. So there's a bunch of steps in page replacement. So we're going to have to choose a page to evict. So, and then we're going to have to load the data, new data. And a bunch of these steps are going to need some data structures. So some, one of the more obvious ones is that we need to figure out, once we've chosen a page to put to load things into, how to load that data, which means we need to know where it is. So we're going to have some way for data that's in files of looking up where that is on disk. We're going to talk about what that looks like when we talk about file systems. We also need some way of looking up, given a virtual address, where it is going to be on disk. And the way Linux implements this, which is a common design choice, is Linux tracks those mmap regions, and if it's mapped to a file, well, we go to the file system data structure. But for things like a private copy of data or heap space, we're going to have some other way of looking it up. The choice that Linux has made is that they said, wait a moment, when we have invalid page table entries, we have all these unused bits in the page table entry, and they store the information in there. Some questions about this is handling our, if we need to load something, where do we load it from problem? So we're loading something into our cache. And so, as I said, this is mostly handled by, we have a list of, you know, where the files are to find it. So another thing we need to do for the page replacement operation, besides knowing what data to load, is we need to remove what was previously in the page. And if it was previously nothing, that's easy. But that's not going to be what we assume is our common case. And removing a page from memory is actually pretty complicated. And one reason is that if we think of our pages, like let's say I'm running 20 copies of cat. In that case, I have 20 page tables that all point to the same data. And if I want to evict what that page from memory that they point to, I need to change all 20 of those page tables. So I need some way of finding all of those page tables. And I guess technically, one way we could do this is you could say that when I have to evict a page, I'm going to scan every single process's page table to see if it's using it. But that's very inefficient. So we're not going to do that. We're going to have some sort of data structure that's going to let us look at a physical page and figure out where it's in use. We're going to have some sort of data structure that lets us look at a physical page and also modify the information about the file that it might be caching to remove it from there so we don't have a dangling pointer and try to access something that's no longer that file's data. So this is going to be part of implementing that eviction, is that we're going to need to have sort of the reverse version of these data structures available to the OS. And so we can remove it from all the page tables that it might be in and find those. And a common solution, sort of what Linux does, is that Linux has a sort of little data, a little struct for every single physical page that points to a list of everyone who's using it. So they can find this. Okay, so questions? Note. Process? Okay. So then we need to worry about allocating a physical page too. So we talked about sort of the mechanics of it. I've chosen a page I want to replace, and I know how to put it, but I need to how do I choose what page to replace? Yes?
I have a question about
So the question is, where is which data structure? The physical page to virtual addresses?
Yes.
This varies between OSs. In Linux, there's basically an array of structs equal to the number of physical pages that has basically a pointer to something like a linked list.
But wouldn't that be huge?
So they do some tricks to make it. So the question is, wouldn't that be really big, having a linked list for every page? So they do some tricks to make it not so big. And one of those tricks is that they they share the same list for the whole mapping rather than each page of the mapping. But it's still not small. Okay, other questions? But yes, but this data structure, I'm not going over, I don't think we have time to like go over the details and what Linux does for it, but yes, they have to do some tricks to make this more compact to make the overhead lower, or they don't have to, but they do. And that is sort of, and it is not a trivial data structure. I would say in the worst case, we could just scan all the page tables. But we just really don't want to do that. Other questions? I said we need to track this reverse mapping, but also, you know, we need to choose what page we're going to replace in the first place. Like, we know how to replace the page now. We know that there's going to be some way of doing a lookup, hopefully an efficient way that's both space and time efficient, but we also need to just find the page. And we want to choose something that's not being used much. That's sort of our intuition. And this is going to be sort of our main next topic is, for page replacement, how do we make the choices about what to replace? And just like with scheduling, we could have different goals for this. So the main goal we're going to be talking about is hit rate. We're going to want to minimize the number of misses, meaning page faults and loading from disk and so on. We could also talk about maximizing throughput, performance. That's very similar to maximizing the hit rate, but it's not the same thing, right? Because loading some things is faster than others, like loading something from a file on an SSD versus a file on disk, different performance. Loading something that involves just filling a page with zeros, a lot faster than loading it from disk. Evicting something where we have to write it to disk, slower than, just getting rid of it and discarding it. So we're going to mostly ignore those issues, but that is something that you might be concerned about in OS. Also, just like with scheduling, we could have goals which sort of aren't about overall performance, like goals about fairness. Like, maybe the way we want to manage the cache is we want to make sure everyone running on, say, portal or something gets an equal share of memory. And we want a very different style of policy to do that. So we're going to talk about optimizing hit rate. As I mentioned, optimizing hit rate is close to optimizing throughput, which is why we're going to look at it. And this is typically what OSs are trying to do. But it's not quite the same thing. Another thing is that I'm going to look at strategies that are reactive for now. There are things that we could do that real OSs do that are proactive, where we can take action before a program tries to use some memory to prevent misses. So one thing we can do, for example, is we can read ahead, that if the program starts executing bincat, we can load the second page of code before it gets there. That's going to speed up performance. That's a thing real OSs will try to do, that sort of thing, and it makes things faster. If a program writes to some file through an mmap version of it, or through write, we can write that to disk right away, rather than waiting for it to be evicted, because we know, well, it needs to be written to disk anyways, and it'll save us time later. That's kind of free. So we'll get back to these sorts of issues a little bit later. We're not going to talk much about them. But for now, I'm just going to assume only doing reactive things, even though, yes, there are proactive things we can do in addition to what we'll talk about that will improve performance, and real OSs do them, and they help a lot. So if we're optimizing for hit rate, under these assumptions that we only bring in things on demand, that we have to wait for the program to try to access something, and we only care about maximizing hashkits, there's an optimal page replacement algorithm. It's the best you can do. And it's called Blaze Min. And the algorithm is pretty simple. You replace the page that's going to be accessed furthest in the future. from when you're doing the replacement. So, nice simple algorithm, little problematic that we can't actually implement it in practice because we need a time machine to figure out what's going to happen in the future. But it is the optimal, so it's worth looking at because we're going to compare the things we can implement to it. And that's what we'll do next time. So questions before I finish up?